Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to Polito Talk with Tanbir, with your host, Tanbir. We haven't had the quick news rundown in a while. I've been doing a progressive summit, as you can see and listen to. Today, I'm honored to host my seventh interview for the progressive summit with Lisa Savage, Green Party nominee for the U.S. Senate in Maine. Good morning, Lisa. How are you?
Good morning, Tanbir. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing good. New York City, where opening up carefully, more carefully than other places. So I'm really honored to be sitting with you having this interview because to me personally, I think this race is perhaps the most unique one happening throughout the country. You're not running as a Democrat or Republican. You're running in Maine, the only state to use ranked choice voting in their elections. And Maine is also one of only two states to have elected and re-elected independent senators. So with all that being said, you may be the first Green Party senator in the history of this country. But before we do get to that, I wanted to ask you, what do you do?
Well, thank you, Tanbir, for having me on, and thanks for your interest in the race. I am just retiring from 25 years as a school teacher in the public schools in central Maine, where I live. And I had planned to work one more year because I was working on a school improvement grant that I'd helped write. But once the Green Party invitation came along and I decided to join this race, I said that if I got ballot access, I would take retirement a year early. And so, wow, what a year to retire from public education.
Right. So for people who may not understand the concept, especially in Maine, where, you know, they're surprisingly still using the vote blue or you're splitting the vote false fear tactic. Could you, as the candidate in a ranked choice voting race, explain what that is?
Sure. Well, the ranked choice voting in Maine works like this. Everyone who gets on the ballot will be listed. And in fact, there is a space for a write-in candidate as well. We gained ballot access by collecting over 9,000 signatures from registered voters on Super Tuesday. I had unenrolled from the Maine Green Party to do that because I attempted ballot access as a Green, which I, you know, was a registered Green Party member. And the system in my state, Maine, makes it almost impossible for a third party to get on the ballot. That really has nothing to do with ranked choice voting. That's just something that Democrats and Republicans have kept in place. So when it became evident that they had rigged the system and it would be impossible, I pivoted, I unenrolled, and as an independent, I could gather signatures from any registered voter, no matter what party, or even if they were unenrolled, which is actually the largest party affiliation in Maine, traditionally, is no party. And then it became, we had a Super Tuesday primary this year in Maine, which doesn't always happen. So we just volunteers spread out to the big polls. And as people came out of the polls on Super Tuesday, we asked them to sign the petition.
All right. So, you know, the DNC Democratic leaders, of course, are intervening in this race. They have been since the Democratic primary as well, since the Republican incumbent Susan Collins is one of the most vulnerable to lose her seat. And, you know, I wouldn't have expected it to be happen in Maine, but it still is, where they're using that vote splitting fear tactic of you have to vote blue or you're letting the Republican win, which, you know, should never be true. And it's definitely not in Maine. So how is your campaign countering that?
Well, it's a very interesting question. The two corporate party candidates, Senator Collins and Sarah Gideon, whom the Democrats nominated, have been following a strategy of completely ignoring ranked choice voting. Those words will never pass their lips, nor do they acknowledge my presence on the ballot. I was actually first on the ballot, but anytime they talk about the race, it's just between the two of them. So that's an interesting strategy on their part. And I tend to respond, our campaign tends to respond by saying, you know, you can ignore ranked choice voting, but it isn't going to make it go away. Actually, the Republican Party in Maine has mounted many challenges to ranked choice voting, including a referendum effort that failed this year, and legal challenges that are ongoing. And as yet, they have not prevailed. But Maine voters have shown on three separate occasions that they want ranked choice voting, and it has passed by a wide margin. So I think that certainly the Republicans are out of step with the sentiment of people in Maine. Because Maine tends to have an electorate that's not super party aligned, people often change their registration just to vote in a primary. As I mentioned, many people are unenrolled. And we have a long history of electing independent candidates. Our other senator is Angus King. He's been reelected, and also he was our governor for two terms as an independent. So, yeah.
Yeah, he's the only independent senator aside from Bernie Sanders. So, you know, Maine definitely has the larger independent base. And it's kind of different when they don't just elect an independent senator, but they reelect them.
Hmm.
So, you know, Gideons and Collins are working out debates, but they are trying not to include you in them. Again, like you said, they're trying to ignore your presence on the ballot. What's the procedure to beat them in this notion and get yourself on the debate stage? What's the criteria and how far are you into it?
Well, thanks for that question. I think that luckily they're not in charge of who's in the debate. Both of them declined to attend some candidate forums that were organized earlier in the season. The rest of us came on those candidate forums, but neither of them would appear. And one of them was organized by the Graduate School of Public Service at University of Southern Maine. You know, a rather prestigious organization that trains a lot of public officials in Maine. And the other one was organized by Youth Climate Strikes and other climate youth groups. So to my mind, those were pretty poor choices to skip those forums. In any case, debates are usually sponsored either by an educational institution or more likely a news outlet. Channel 6 News has already indicated to us that we will be included in their debate, that we do have ballot access, and that's all we really needed to do to qualify. So, you know, the pronouncements of my opponents about debates don't really hold a lot of, they don't have the authority to exclude me from the debates. Let's put it that way.
That's good news. I didn't know about the Channel 6 one. That's great, because that's a large part of why people don't know they have more than two choices, the debates. So you're the only candidate running on popular progressive policies like Medicare for All, Green New Deal, marijuana legalization and ending the regime and endless wars. Over 80% of Democrats support policies like Medicare for All, and even a majority of independents and large portion of Republicans do as well. Yet neither two party leaderships show any willingness to work towards it. So how will you convince registered Democrats and Republicans in Maine, despite being the minority groups, you know, how will you convince them to vote for you as their first choice?
Yeah, that's a great question. Now that the Democratic primary concluded this month, it was postponed because of the pandemic. I am the only candidate who supports Medicare for All, which the majority of people in Maine do favor, and especially with the public health crisis that COVID-19 has created. People are very aware that healthcare shouldn't be tied to employment, and, you know, having everyone have adequate healthcare is a public health issue. So it's interesting to me that issue, which was important to my campaign before the pandemic came along, has now become the number one issue that people are looking at. Right now, in about 3 minutes, I know we're recording this, we are going to announce that we're being endorsed by one of the Democratic candidates that was in the primary race. And Bridgman is the first openly non-binary candidate to run for the U.S. Senate. And Bree Kidman is endorsing us because largely we stand for Medicare for All. And the House Speaker, Sarah Gideon, she's the Speaker of the Maine House of Representatives,
right,
is not, supporting Medicare for All because she takes donations from the big pharma and big health insurance companies that profit from us not having a system of universal single-payer health care. I think all I need to do is convince the people of Maine. I have pledged not to take donations from corporate lobbyists, corporate executives, or the super PACs that launder corporate money so you can claim you don't take it while you really are. And I am in a position to represent what the people of Maine want, not what my very wealthy donors out of state want me to go into the Senate and do. And I think that's a unique offering for the people of Maine. We've had Susan Collins for quite a while now, and she very much does the bidding of her corporate donors.
Right. I'm glad you informed me about the Bree Kidman endorsement, because that was a future question I was going to ask. Sarah, so I guess I'll go to that one and then come back. So Sarah Gideon was up against two progressive Democrats in the primary, who ran on your platform as well. So how are you doing, and what's your plan on appealing to the voters who voted for Betsy Sweet? I would ask for Bree Kidman too, but she's endorsing you, so that's a very good thing to have. So as far as Betsy Sweet voters go, what's your appeal?
Well, again, Medicare for All has been very important. One of the young influencers who was part of Betsy's media team came right over to us as soon as the primary was over and endorsed us. So that was very helpful. And, you know, we have social media platforms, of course, that where we can identify who supported various candidates or are people that are very interested in issues, and we can reach out to them that way. And that's been quite successful. Also, we're doing a series of educational webinars on issues of importance to voters, and we are drawing from our endorser list. So we started out with one on the cost of war with Chris Hedges, and then followed up with one on racial injustice at home and abroad with Ajamu Baraka, who was the vice presidential Green Party candidate last election cycle. And then this Friday, we're doing one on Medicare for All. And one of the panelists is Dr. Margaret Flowers, who's a prominent advocate of single payer and also ran for the Senate in Maryland, where she lives, as a Green Party candidate a few years back. And we have also a representative, Dr. Bill Clark of Maine All Care. Maine All Care is the state level organization that works to get single payer universal health care, you know, at the state level. And then also we have a very interesting health educator, Glenn Simpson, works in the recovery community and works on harm reduction, and in particular works with using art as a way to address substance dependence and recovery from that. Substance abuse and dependence is a very big issue in Maine that cuts across all age groups, income levels, geographic areas, and, you know, ethnic and racial areas in Maine. It's a real unifier, and not in a good way. So I do believe that if people could understand, oh, we don't treat substance abuse like the mental health issue it is, for one thing, because we don't have universal health care to address it. We criminalize it. And then that's a very, you know, creates great racial inequities in our incarceration rate, so forth. We had a good presenter on that in our racial justice webinar. So this Friday at 5, we're looking forward to having our webinar on Medicare for All. And, we've gotten a lot of outreach, and many people signed up to view it, or, sometimes, how many webinars there are these days. If a person can't make it at 5 p.m. on Friday Eastern time, if they register, then they still get a link to the recorded webinar after the fact.
Right. I wanted to ask, so a lot of people support Medicare for All, but also a lot of people think they believe that the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, is in some way, you could say, a stepping stone to Medicare for All. Why do you think that it's not? Why do you think that the ACA should be repealed and replaced with Medicare for All?
Well, first off, because there are millions of people with no health care under the AA, the Affordable Care Act. I think it's interesting that when you ask people in Maine, especially Republican voters, do you like the Affordable Care Act? They say yes, because that's how I finally got health insurance. But if you ask them if they like Obamacare, they say no, but it's two names for the exact same thing. But many people that I know, middle class people and working class people, they may have health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, but they cannot afford to use it. The premiums are so high and the deductible is so high that they really just have it for catastrophic events like getting in an accident. I have friends that fly to Mexico for their medical and dental care. It's actually cheaper for them to go there and get medical care than it is to stay in Maine and use their, for-profit health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. I've been lucky enough to be a school teacher all these years, for the last 25 years, and I'm part of the biggest collective bargaining unit in the state. that you know, deals with the private insurer on behalf of not only school employees but state employees, and the power of collective bargaining in you know, obtaining reasonable rates and reasonable coverage should not be understated. I don't think that, and I believe that until the government takes on to be the single payer and negotiate with health providers, I don't believe that, you know, the families of the students that I've been working with will receive health care until we go down that road.
Right. So another question I did want to ask is more on campaign finance. You've been endorsed by Jill Stein and Ajamu Baraka, the Green Party president and vice president nominees for 2016, as well as a series of environmental activists, authors, veterans, and local state candidates. But again, you're up against the Democratic and Republican Party. Without a doubt, they're pouring millions into this race. Susan Collins is vulnerable. Sarah Gideon is the DNC powerhouse right now. Voter outreach and ensuring there's name familiarity is crucial to win through phone banking, text banking, mailers, and even campaign buses and billboards. So what's your campaign's approach, and how do you guys plan on getting the necessary funds to do all these things?
It's a very good question. We know that we cannot compete on the level of, you know, raising $40 million. You'd have to, you'd have to take corporate money to do that. We have raised about $100,000 from grassroots donations, both in Maine and some donors outside of Maine who really want to see ranked choice voting and or a green candidate prevail. But $100,000 does not pay much staff or buy much. You know, media buys are very expensive, obviously. So, you know, we have some different strategies. We have a great team of very dedicated volunteers that continues to grow. We're tabling at places like farmers markets, where the audience is likely to be receptive to our message. Our webinar series has been a good outreach to build our name recognition. We'll be doing a bookmobile, giving books, free books away to children when school starts, traveling around the state. This is a project that I've wanted to do for years as a teacher, a summer slump. In other words, the drop in reading achievement during the summer months has always been a big issue for me in education. And I always wanted to have a bookmobile. So I finally get my chance. There will be a surprise publication that I would rather not reveal the details of right now, but around that same time too. And then, you know, just on a smaller scale, for instance, we have just ordered condoms with our branding on one side rendered in rainbow colors. So Lisa for Maine rendered in rainbow, because we fully support LGBTQIA rights and, you know, full access to health care and every other thing in society. And on the other side, it will say that we support Medicare for all. And handing out condoms as a protection and saying, we want to protect you in every way. We want to protect you with Medicare for all. We feel we'll reach also a certain audience. And then, you know, just doing outreach to networks of people that have reason to perhaps support us. The next webinar after Medicare for All will be on our opposition to Hydro-Québec's so-called New England Clean Connect corridor, which is a giant high-power electric transmission line they are proposing to build from megadam projects in Quebec to deliver power to Massachusetts. And they want to cut a swath the size of the New Jersey Turnpike through the Maine woods to do this. Maine will hardly benefit at all. But that also is a very unifying issue in Maine. People of all parties and no parties are against that. The only people in Maine that I'm aware that are in favor of that project are people that will profit from it.
Right. So COVID-19, now to get to that, virus and pandemic, our leaders in D.C. have failed horribly at handling, whether you're looking at it from the side of Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell failed, or Nancy Pelosi as well. They're failing in providing aid as well. You know, we've all seen the horrible Republican stimulus package. And you called for a people's bailout. So I wanted to ask, what is included on your people's bailout?
Well, our people's bailout, first and foremost, would address income security. There needs to be an emergency universal basic income instituted because people can't stay home and not do their jobs if they literally can't keep a roof over their head or groceries on the table. Also, housing security has become a huge issue under the pandemic. The eviction freeze is just about to expire, and the rent freezes that were put in place just kind of kicked the can down the road. They didn't actually provide any rent relief. They simply said, okay, you don't have to pay the rent for 3 months. But if you're out of work, not paying the rent for 3 months doesn't make you able to pay it, you know, and on the fourth month, all the back rent that was owed. Right. So definitely relief for not only renters, but like, you know, homeowner mortgages. Those people, there again, there's likely to be a lot of, you know, defaults on mortgages, and as people aren't able to work and pay for, keep their housing in place. Universal health care would be really nice right now, because how many people lost health care because they lost their job? And the Democratic Party just has, you know, championed tying health care, health insurance, to employment. And now in the pandemic, I think we've seen why that is such a spectacularly bad idea, and one that no other wealthy countries think is a good idea. I don't know why, you know, we think that only we understand that that's the way to do things. So those are the three most important parts of, you know, a bailout for the people. I think also, I feel that bailing out the states and the municipalities. We've seen Congress bail out big corporations and hugely wealthy entities several times now. They have yet to pass a bill providing meaningful relief to the state of Maine or the city of Portland or, you know, and school districts, which I've been working for the last several years, are going to be in dire straits while being asked to reopen under completely new circumstances with lots of expenditures to, you know, conduct school safely. And the states have lost an enormous amount of revenue because the economy, you know, shut down so much that revenues from sales tax. Maine survives largely on tourism during the summer and early fall months. And there are a few tourists here this year, but nothing like there usually are. So, you know, Congress needs to take a look at that and realize that bailing out cruise ships is not what's needed, but bailing out states and municipalities is urgent. It's overdue, and there's going to be a disaster if it isn't done pretty quickly.
Right. I'm glad you brought up the, you know, the months of rent stacking up despite moratoriums and everything, because my next point is that a new map released by CNBC shows how evictions will look in each state, and they're very ugly numbers. I think the lowest percentage was 28% in a state, which is still alarming. So how would you, as a U.S. senator, and then also the Democratic lawmakers, they came up with you could call it aid. It's to provide legal funds to fight evictions, but that's not a very feasible thing. You know, so how would you, as a U.S. senator, work towards addressing this? It always has been a housing crisis, but yes, Right now it's more evident than before. So, mm-hmm. And how would you work towards passing a Housing for All plan?
Well, I think that there are many parts to providing housing as a human right. First off, in the emergency, we need to give people the money to pay their rent or their mortgage payments. And when Congress tells us there's not money for that, gee, there's money to militarize all the police forces. There's money to drop a bomb on someone outside the U.S. every few minutes, but there's never money to keep people in their housing. That, you know, I reject those budget priorities. I think budgets are moral documents, and we need to get our, you know, our values straight. Moving forward, though, we would also have to address what's already a disaster of homelessness, people experiencing homelessness. I'm not sure if you're aware that the city of Portland is in a state of extreme crisis right now. The only nonprofit in the city of Portland that was providing services like showers and bathrooms and the others were other, they had a soup kitchen, but they weren't the only ones doing providing feeding, but they had to close down under the pandemic because they didn't have the physical plant to be able to do it safely. And so they continued providing meals, but taking them out into the field. And it's summertime now in Maine, so many people experiencing homelessness are camping in the parks, and they were delivering food there. But then the city told them, "You, Preble Street, you cannot serve people meals in the parks because it's creating trash, and there's literally no place for homeless people to use the bathroom if they're not in a shelter, and there's no place for them to shower if they're not in a shelter." So they have camped out on the front steps of City Hall for the last week. They're having a tent in. Yesterday, the mayor came down and spoke to them. Every time I visited the tent in, it has grown. It now occupies an entire city block in downtown Portland. And I'm aware that the crisis of unhoused people is extreme in New York City, in Los Angeles, in the San Francisco Bay Area, and many other places as well. This needs to be addressed through supportive housing. Some people simply need housing. And there are areas, I believe that there's a city in Colorado that approached it through, let's deal with housing first. Let's get people housed. Then we will move on to addressing other issues that they may need support with. But one of my campaign team that has worked closely with the Portland housing advocacy group said, you know, a lot of the people that are in the tent in need supportive housing. They need housing with wraparound services, mental health care, substance abuse care, you know, social workers to help them find employment and so forth. So I think that a comprehensive approach to meeting the needs of people that are living on the sidewalks is not only the humane thing to do, and not only the thing that other wealthy countries do with their wealth, but also during the pandemic, it's a public health issue.
I definitely agree. And I wanted to ask another question on policy. I wanted to ask, how would it benefit Maine specifically if you do support creating a federal banking system through our postal services? How would it benefit postal workers in Maine and then also, you know, regular people in Maine as well?
Could you repeat the question, Tanvir?
Yes, no problem. So if you support creating a federal banking system through our postal services, how would it directly benefit postal workers in Maine as well as other citizens in Maine?
Okay, yeah. So other countries do have this, don't they? They provide banking services through their post office, and it seems to work fine there. The post office, as we know, is under attack. Susan Collins is unpopular in Maine among postal workers, both retired and current, because she was a sponsor of the bill that undercut the financial stability of the U.S. Postal Service. I believe that bill passed in 2015 or around about there. And it forced the U.S. Postal Service to fund their retirement out 75 years, which is an unreasonable expectation that no other government entities or companies have to do. And so now we see the U.S. Postal Service is kind of wobbling, and many of us are trying to support it by using as many of the services that, you know, we're able to, but that probably isn't enough. So allowing them to also conduct banking, which would be a service to people just that need to have access to a sort of a low impact banking option. And the U.S. postal workers themselves would, you know, the Postal Service could gain revenue from providing that service. I believe that the attack on the Postal Service is part of an overall strategy to undercut access to voting in the run up to the 2020 election. We're seeing claims here in Maine. The postal workers in Portland have said that the postmaster there has been telling them to leave the regular mail in the post office and deliver Amazon packages instead. And lots of people who are like attorneys or, you know, other people who depend on the mails to get their work done, businesses that ship things, are reporting really extreme delays in the type of delivery you know, promptness that they had come to expect from years of dealing with the Postal Service. So creating a federal banking system to shore up the post office would be a great idea. The post office is one of the few government agencies that's, you know, was created at the inception of this country. And many people in rural Maine, where I live, depend on it for their Social Security check, their medications. If the Postal Service went away, there would be many needs unmet. So, you know, we should do all we can to save it. My campaign has a petition about saving the post office, and it seems to be well understood that this is a service we do not want to lose.
Right. And, you know, one of the important questions I wanted to ask, should you win, you would be the third independent senator in the Senate, first Green Party one. And how would you work with Democrats and Republicans? Because it's not like Democrats working with Republicans or vice versa. You have to try to work with both of them, who may not necessarily align in your interests. Because, you know, both parties have corporate donors and influence. So how would you work with them to pass your platform and policies?
Well, it's a very good question, Tambir. One thing that I know about coming in as the new kid on the block is to, you know, contact. I mean, people like to ask, you haven't asked the silliest question. The silly question a journalist asked me is, what are you going to do on your first day in the Senate? Well, I've had many jobs in my life. And the first day on the job, you find out where the bathroom is. You know, learn your coworkers' names, you know, find out who's supporting you and thank them. So I jokingly say my first day in the Senate, I'm going to call Bernie and then I'm going to meet with Maine constituents that are in Washington, D.C., you know, visiting. But clearly there are some opportunities that one senator has. And clearly there are some opportunities for caucusing with other parties. Yeah. One thing that's interesting is that if I re-enroll as a Green after the election, which is perfectly legal, if I go ahead and do that, I believe there are some opportunities to form your own caucus if you enter the Senate as a party, you know, the member of a party. Would that be advisable? That I don't know. You know, it requires some thought and some research and consulting with various people that would know more about that. But I think it's a very interesting opportunity. And Maine is a fairly small or at least low population state. The number of constituents that a Maine senator represents is tiny compared to a state like New York. But in the U.S. Senate, as a senator who's coming in new, obviously you don't have the seniority that someone like Senator Collins has, but you know, a big influence for me was Senator Margaret Chase Smith. My grandfather went to high school with her, and they were friends during their adult years because he went into politics at the state level. And, you know, she was famous. She catapulted to fame after she was elected to the House, and then she was elected to the Senate. She was freshman senator, and Joe McCarthy was terrorizing everyone with accusations that they were communists and ruining careers. And she delivered a speech called the Declaration of Conscience speech, where she basically said, "You can't bully me. I'm from Maine. We don't like bullies. Go ahead, call me un-American. You know, I'm not going to kowtow to someone who's trying to, you know, use fear and threats." And, you know, one of the lines in that speech that I've always liked a lot is that she said, you know, it seems to me that the people that are screaming the most about being American are forgetting some of the most basic things about being American, which is the right to hold unpopular opinions. So I don't have any problem with standing up, even if nobody else agrees with me, and saying my piece and, you know, not being, I'm not, it's not easy to intimidate me with threats and so forth. The family story about my grandfather, he was in the Maine Senate when the big hydropower plants went in Maine, and a lobbyist said to him, "If you don't vote with us when this comes to the floor, we're going to hurt you." And the family lore is that my grandfather said, "Only my son or my wife could hurt me. What are you talking about?" So I have that kind of attitude going in. I'm not trying to build a fortune or a, you know, long career. I want to represent the people of Maine honestly and with integrity, and that's what I intend to do.
All right. So my last question for you is simple, kind of like any final message, but why are you the right choice for Maine? I know you kind of answered a huge portion of that already, but
Well, one reason I think is that I am a mom and a grandmother. My children are grown and I have grandchildren, and I'm worried about their future. And I know that a lot of people in Maine are similarly worried about the future of the people they love. I do have some experience as an elected official of my teachers union. I was the vice president and chief negotiator of my local bargaining unit of the Maine Education Association for several years. And that was a good learning experience for, you know, in a project like running for the Senate, I'm the spokesperson. I'm just one member of a very large team of talented individuals that are dedicated to this project. So I have the skills to be a spokesperson. And one of the things I learned from that experience was it's mostly about listening to what the group that you're representing cares about, and having some skill at sort of sensing what is the consensus here, because there's always going to be a lot of varied opinions, but what will the people that I'm speaking for support? So, you know, when I go to the Senate, I need to not only have a firm idea that day what the people of Maine want, but I need to constantly stay in touch with the people of Maine to, you know, to represent them honestly. So I think I'm the best candidate because I'm not going to take money from the corporations that have brought the worst form of government. I mean, our government, the form of government that we're living under now is a dictatorship of the corporations, and the needs of the people are, every time you think austerity couldn't get much worse, it gets worse. So I think we absolutely need representatives that are the voice of the people and not the voice of the already wealthy corporations.
I definitely do agree. Thank you so much for being on here, Lisa. I'm rooting for you from New York City.
Thank you.
I'm a registered Democrat, but that's for primaries. You know, mm-hmm. I don't believe in blind party loyalty. So again, I'm very interested in your race. To the listeners out there, visit www.lisaformaine.org to volunteer and donate and check out what Lisa is running on, and follow her on Twitter at Lisa for Maine. Both will be written in this episode's bio for you to use as reference. Also, follow me on Twitter at It's Tim Beer C. Subscribe to Polita Talk with Tim Beer on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Share and give it a rating if you'd like. It's greatly appreciated. Again, Lisa, thank you very much. It was an honor sitting here. I wish everyone and your families a safe, great day and week.
Thank you, Tim Beer. My pleasure.